Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All. Less work, more clean. Terms apply.
The Athletic.
The race is on, and Sergio Perez flipped the usual order by leading home Max Verstappen in another Red Bull 1-2 in the Saudi Arabian Grand Prix. But are the cracks starting to show as the two drivers jostle for advantage? And what was the deal with Fernando Alonso's on-off-on third place? I'm Ed Straw, and joining us to answer all the questions from the Saudi Arabian Grand Prix are Mark Hughes and Scott Mitchell-Malm. Well, Scott, a classic late one at the circuit.
Yeah, very much a late finish, aided by, I think we can say, the first real penalty controversy of 2023. Been a while since we had one of these, so yeah, always nice when they keep us waiting for results, stewards' documents, real explanations, stuff like that. So after, given the first couple of installments of this race, a relatively sensible Grand Prix, even though there was an inevitable safety car.
Yeah, well, that's always the case when it comes to this circuit. High speed, full of character, relatively well-behaved Grand Prix though, overall, wasn't it, Mark?
It was, but I was actually quite surprised to see the safety car for that, because it looked like Lance Stroll had sort of got the car to a reasonably safe place, and I would have thought it was a VSC. But as you say, Scott, very high speed and walls there. I suppose they were playing, you know, better safe than sorry. But I mean, the safety car did sort of, it was probably a little bit of a blessing in a way, because it set up the battle between the Red Bulls, at least, and that gave us a race.
The safety car was, I think a few people wondered whether it was merited. And obviously the conspiracy theorists were thinking, oh, that's convenient for Verstappen, we needed him at the front, and oh, there's a safety car for no reason. But apparently it was because when Stroll stopped initially, the cameras that they had available at the time, it wasn't entirely clear exactly where he'd stopped and if the car was in a safe place. So, as you put it, Mark, they decided better safe than sorry, deployed the safety car, and then I think a few seconds later thought, ah, that was unnecessary.
Yeah, those things happen. They always take it very cautiously with safety cars, which is fine when there's marshals and recovery vehicles and that kind of thing involved. So you can understand that maybe once in a while, even though it's slightly strange they didn't have the angles available given the control centre they've got and all the views in race control. But anyway, it's always very easy to criticise that sort of thing. But let's get on with it, Scott. Fernando Alonso finished third in this race. He stood on the podium, then he lost third place to a 10-second penalty. And then a little after 1 a.m, he got his third place back. So what absurd sequence of events explains all of this?
Absurd is the perfect word for it. So yeah, so he obviously had a 5-second penalty for being out of position at the start. Very rarely see this in Formula One. There's usually one a season or two. Now we've had two in two races after Esteban Ocon had one in Bahrain. So he gets his 5-second penalty. He needs to serve it at his first and only pit stop. You're not allowed to work on the car while you're serving that time penalty. Alonso serves the penalty, goes away. There's no issue or no sign of any issue. But then right at the end of the Grand Prix, we find out that Alonso's been, or not even at the end of the Grand Prix, after the Grand Prix, he's been on the podium, he's got the trophy, and then he's walking, as I understand it, walking down out of the, you know, the podium room, down the steps, and basically gets told, 10-second penalty, chief, and literally has the trophy taken off him, because
I quite like the fact that they have an official trophy yoinking just to add insult to injury,
just to be as prompt as possible. And basically this is because it's a bit convoluted, but the pit stop was initially reviewed at the time by both race control and the remote operation center that the FIA has, which has been active for the last year or so. And actually at the time, both of them determined that the penalty had been properly served, i.e. nobody had touched the car or been working on the car while the penalty was being served. So that was fine. But they basically changed their minds right at the end of the Grand Prix. On the last lap of the race, the remote operation center reported to race control that they considered the penalty hadn't actually been properly served. Race control then referred this to the stewards. The stewards then basically looked at it and went, ah, actually, rear jack is engaged. It's touching the back of the car. Car's not lifted, but it's touching. That counts as being worked on. That's established that that's being worked on. So it's a 10-second penalty. Makes sense, right?
Yep, that's all fine so far.
That's just accepted convention in Formula One. Unless you start to interrogate the rules and the way that this this particular regulation is enforced. The reason that they got the penalty is that it's been previously established in the Sporting Advisory Committee meetings that no part of the car can be touched while the penalty is being served, and that touching the car counts as working on it. Aston Martin basically challenged this, and essentially they've been able to successfully argue that the stewards were wrong to believe that there is an emphatic argument or emphatic agreement in place that the jack touching a car should be considered working on it, because there is actually precedent, quite a lot of precedent, for when the front jack is in use, the front jack's allowed to touch the car in this scenario, because the front jack is used to guide the car's positioning coming into the pit box. What Aston Martin's basically argued is, because of the way I think it's been phrased in all of these Sporting Advisory Committee meetings, a jack's a jack. Doesn't matter whether it's at the front of the car or the back of the car. So if you're going to let the front jack touch the car, then the rear jack's okay as well. So as I understand it, this exception's never been granted on the rear jack. The spirit of this rule and the way it's implemented is essentially that you can do the front jack. You don't touch it with the rear jack. Everyone accepts this, and that's just how it's enforced. But there's no explicit regulation on this. So basically, the whole application of the rule is built on sand, and as soon as someone wanted to interrogate it, which Aston Martin did because there was a podium on the line, that's it. You've had a massive problem with the rule and a contradiction exposed.
Now, there's been a lot of criticism about the FIA for this, which is perfectly reasonable. But I think all credit to Aston Martin for finding a load of precedents and saying, well, hang on, fighting their corner. As you say, there's a podium at stake. So, of course, they're going to try and do that. And putting together your case very, very quickly, showing some video footage of Jack's involved, you're onto a winner.
They think they found 7 previous instances in which the front jack had been touching the car. I just like the idea that, like, when as soon as this happened, there was someone somewhere in Aston Martin just went, oh no, wait, hang on, I've got this, and just run around like collecting. I want to know what the pit stops were. Like, what were the specific 7? Like, I love that someone either had this in memory or they just had it somewhere written down. We might need this one day. So it's good. I think it's good. Good sporting directoring, I would say.
I'm looking forward to the video highlights at the end of the year where we can see that. We can see all the different instances of the front jack touching. That's going to be fantastic viewing. I'm really looking forward to that. That's great.
Be a great compilation video in slow motion.
Yeah, the FIA should put that out as well. Just lean into it and just say, here's a compilation of past precedents that we disregarded.
Great
but,
jack moments.
It's made F1 obviously be a little bit of a laughing stock in that regard, because people say, well, you should know the result. But obviously we had the finickiness about the positioning in the grid boxes and then this going on with not serving the penalty right now. What did you make of all of this, Mark, just in terms of, are there too many penalties going around? And then, of course, are there too many penalties going around and then being rescinded?
if you don't hand them out, you don't have to rescind them afterwards. It'd be great if there was a system in place where, you know, somebody just had a word and said, look, you're a little bit out of line there. Don't do that again. And can we work on a system whereby the driver can maybe see the white lines or the yellow lines or whatever? It all happens behind closed doors. It's just a sort of bureaucracy within the sport. It'd be great if that wasn't sort of imposed on the viewer as part of the competition. But there you go.
Yeah, I kind of see the need to enforce the grid slots because people will take liberties. But as you pointed out, because the visibility is so dire and the driver, they can see the lines on the edge marking the sides of the box as they approach, but then they basically disappear as they get close. So you can understand why that's pretty tricky, and something perhaps needs to be done to improve that a little bit. But then, of course, you then get this spiral, don't you, of the penalty served. And of course, Alonso mitigated the penalty, or rather the safety car mitigated the penalty, because he was able to serve it under the safety car. And in case anyone's wondering, you are allowed to serve those penalties under the safety car. In fact, the rules state that even if you come in under the VSC or safety car, that's when you serve those penalties.
Yeah, and I think part of it's just a run on from, you know, the size and the complication of the cars and where the bodywork is, and that's why the visibility is, you know, so tricky up close. It's almost like they need, you know, some big MPV like cars that have reversing cameras on, so you can see where you're going when you're going backwards. It's almost like we've got to the stage where you're going to need that on the F1 cars, isn't it?
I think that I like the for the lining up on the grid slot. I think we should have like speedway style tape for each. Just instead of having staggered grid positions where you have 1-1-1, just have them speedway style, four rows of four. Start them all in the line. Little bit of ticker tape over the front to stop anyone going too far. There you go. You run right up to it. Nose up to the perfect. Job done. Be more fun going down to turn one.
Or stick them all in a Lotus 25 or something, and then you have no problem with the visibility and being able to see the ground. But certainly, yeah, I understand why they're being quite cautious on this kind of thing, because you have to have some limits, and drivers will take liberties and advantages. But I think they need to have a little bit of a think about the grid slot thing.
The grid slot thing is fine. I mean, it's harsh, but it's harsh for a reason. I think the whole saga was, for me, typical F1, in that you had this stupidly niche, microscopic rule controversy, storm in a teacup style thing. But the big disappointment for me in terms of the way it came across was that for Alonso, you had a situation where he's celebrating his 100th podium in Formula One. It's a real milestone. It's a proper result. And because of a slightly clumsy bit of decision making in the first instance, it's dragged right out. So it impacts that. And then we have this back and forth that's protracted. I mean, to be fair, they ended up resolving it relatively quickly within a few hours of the race finishing, which, you know, sometimes it does end up going into the days that follow. But it is dragged out. The result that you saw at the checkered flag was in doubt for hours after the race. We didn't think we'd seen exactly how it had played out, and it's just needlessly confusing. I think this is the sort of stuff that whatever way it can, F1 has to get away from, because there are just too many of these. And a bit of controversy is fun. I'm sure we've had lots of people reading our news stories this evening, and they'll be watching videos and listening to this podcast wanting to find out what happened. But it just feels a little bit mounting out of a molehill.
Yeah, and George Russell was talking about the need to look through some of these penalties and try and improve things. Obviously, there were some track limits penalties as well, but unusually they were for track limits basically on the straights, in terms of people taking a little bite out of that Qatar Airways logo that divides the track from the pit entry. That caught out Logan Sargeant in particular in qualifying. So, yeah, there's a few things I need to look at there and some clarity. But at the same time, you do have to have some rules, and whenever there are lines, there has to be a line somewhere. There is a point where you're on the line, or you're within the line, and then like 1 millimeter later, you're over it. So you have to have an absolute limit, but it just needs to be communicated properly and applied consistently and with clarity. But Mark, we should talk about the performance of the Aston Martin, because we were wondering whether it would be as strong as it was in Bahrain. Different circuit characteristics here. Still pretty strong. Fernando Alonso on the front row, I know aided by circumstances, but that was still, therefore, a second row car. Led the race early on, not for very long, because Perez quite quickly got past, but pretty strong again from them.
Yeah, it just sort of confirmed where it was in Bahrain, didn't it? It's the second fastest car. It's not that far clear of the Mercedes and Ferrari on ultimate race pace, but in Saudi, it even managed to out-qualify them. So when you look at it's quick, it is very, very quick in the corners. It's quicker than the Red Bull in some corners. And, yeah, it's a draggier car. And so when you – the Mercedes and the Ferrari, they lack the corner and speed of the Red Bull, but are almost as fast on the straights. So – they derived their lap time in a quite different way to the Aston, but the Aston's way of doing it compared to the Ferrari Mercedes seems to have made a car that is better on its tyres and you know, just a generally better proposition all round. It's still a big chunk away from the Red Bull, and I think we sort of had our hopes up a little bit because, you know, given that Max was starting 15th, if you looked at Perez's long run on Friday and compared to Alonso's, it was only a couple of tenths ahead. But the real difference, once you know, because you're doing simulation on Friday, you're sort of taking an educated guess at where you can pitch your pace and do a stint length, and you know you fine tune that when you get more data, and in the actual race you could see where the real pace was, and it was way more than 2/10. It was a much quicker car, but it's great that the Aston can still do that on a very different track. So I think it'll be quite interesting when we get to some of the high downforce tracks and see how it goes there. Not that I'm thinking it's going to be challenging a Red Bull. I don't think anything will. But I think it's going to be interesting to see what Fernando could pull out of it.
And of course, Lance Stroll also had a good first part of the race before an ERS problem put him out. He ran fourth early on. He did lose a little bit around the pit stops, but that does show the car is all round strong. Do you think this car is going to be a fixture here now for the season, assuming they do make development progress? Because if they keep getting these kind of results and these kind of positions, there could be a win on the cards at some point, couldn't there?
I think so, yeah. I think, you know, as Fernando pointed out, he's optimistic that there'll be a day when a Red Bull doesn't finish. And you hear more and more about what happened with the car in Bahrain and how on tenterhooks the Red Bull pit wall was there about the, you know, the concerns about the cars finishing there. And we had the same thing with both cars here. Yeah, it's quite conceivable. And if it happens, you would imagine that the Aston's going to be a good chance it's going to be first in line to take advantage. I think also Stroll's, he followed up that great gritty Bahrain performance with a pretty handy performance here as well. And he did that beautiful move to get past Sainz on the first lap. It looked like he was just a little bit too greedy and he's in the third sector of his qualifying lap. Otherwise he was, you know, in with a real shout of doing an Alonso like time, maybe even better. So yeah, I think it speaks well both of Stroll's development, but also that this is a really very, very good car, and that I think, given that its basics are there and they're not, you know, it's just doesn't have the same combination of downforce and lack of drag as the Red Bull, but it's balanced. It's got lots of downforce, so I think it's probably established as a better foundation than what Ferrari and Mercedes currently have. I think the prospects for that car are good, and I don't think it's just a flash in the pan. That I think they are there. They as the leading contender, I would say, at the moment to be runners-up.
And if you look at their prospects over the course of the season, yeah, compared to the Red Bull, you have to assume that the RB19 is further along its development curve than the AMR23. So there's potentially more performance to be found in the Aston Martin. And as the season goes on, we think of how low Aston Martin was in the championship last year. They've got a lot more aerodynamic testing that they can do, whether wind tunnel time, CFD work, than Red Bull. And Red Bull will switch focus to 2024, I'm sure, probably as early as they possibly can, especially if they rack up points and get an advantage. Now, Aston Martin doesn't want to compromise its long-term process, but any development it does on the 23 car will directly feed the 24 car because it's a bit more immature in the development of this concept. They've got more ATR work to play with. I can see, if you take it from the start of the season to the end, why shouldn't Aston Martin develop their car more than Red Bull does and get more performance relative over the season than Red Bull does? And if that's the case, they'll get even closer, and these 15, 20 second deficits that need a little bit of a helping hand to get on real level terms becomes a 5, 10, 12 second deficit, and all of a sudden you need, over the course of the season, less and less to go wrong to let someone like Alonso steal in. So I think it's entirely possible that he wins a race this season.
Yeah, it's certainly good to see Alonso leading those first few laps, definitely where he belongs in F1, and I think everybody would be delighted to see him continuing to fight at the front and maybe picking up that elusive first win since 2013 at some point this year. Right, well, Mark, the traditional how the race was won question's relatively straightforward given the supremacy of the Red Bull. So perhaps the question is this. Given Verstappen got up to second place behind his teammate by half distance with an assist from the safety car, why wasn't he able to catch and pass his teammate?
His teammate was really quick this weekend. And, you know, once the safety car had effectively given us a restart with Max only a couple of cars and 5 seconds behind, by the time he dealt with those two cars, it was Russell and Alonso, he was just 5 seconds behind. So that was effectively the reset. They were both on new hard tyres, which were very robust around here. You could really push on them. The mediums a bit less so that they used in the first stint. But on these tyres, it was game on. And, you know, Sergio was just really, really quick this weekend, as he'd been in Bahrain, actually. But his weekend didn't go as well there. But, yeah, he knew very much what the challenge was. And he had about him a sort of steely conviction that, he wasn't just going to lie down and let this happen. He was absolutely going to nail it. And Fernando, I think, took 12 laps to get the gap down from 5.4 to 4.3. That's how little the pace difference was, you know. So, then the game of trying to control the pace because of the concerns about the reliability began. And then that discussion, which was quite amusing, all took place. And it was funny hearing GP asking Max for the target lap time, which by coincidence was exact same target lap time as he was asking for him in Bahrain. It was 33.0, and I think at the time Max was doing like 32.2s. And he just complete radio silence in response. And he broke the radio silence only to say, "What's the fastest lap?" So, yeah, which he duly said on the last lap. So, yeah, I mean, the reason why he was unable to do it was because he couldn't find that 5 seconds because Perez was too quick for him to take 5 seconds off him. He was able to take a little bit off him, but not enough.
Yeah, and certainly given that Verstappen looked like he had supremacy over a single lap by some margin, certainly if he hadn't had the drive shaft problem in Q2, he'd have been on pole by quite a big margin. On race pace, it was a much different thing, and all credit to Perez for dealing with that. But Scott, how well do you think Red Bull played managing its drivers, and do you have any problem with how the drivers handled that situation?
I think Red Bull did all they could in the circumstances. There was this reliability concern that Verstappen had flagged. They looked into it. They obviously had a minor worry about it. But I think if it had ever reached the point of being a critical issue, I think we would have heard a much more serious intervention. There would have been a lot more iteration from GP for Verstappen. We may even have heard other voices come over the radio basically saying, stop playing games now. That said, I think it showed that ultimately Red Bull does have a driver in Verstappen that he will basically push the limits and go beyond them in terms of pursuing what's best for him. Because that pace management was imposed for a reason. It wasn't done to, you know, mess Verstappen over or anything like that. It was just let's just get to the end now. This is done. And Max didn't want that. And that's why Max is how he is as a driver. He wants every point, whether it's for the fastest lap. If he thinks that there's a chance that he can still catch Perez and win, he's going to try and catch Perez and win. And Christian Horner kind of tried to shrug it off and just be like, well, I think he basically suggested that Max would rather have forced his own retirement chasing a win than settle for second. I don't think that's the most most productive relationship to have, like, in all situations in the long term. But on reflection, like I said, if it had got properly critical, I think it would have been handled differently, and I suspect it would have been respected from Verstappen, but I think he just saw an opportunity to just push things as far as he could. And ultimately, in the end, he did get a bit of what he wanted because he was able to. He did decide to just go for the fastest lap, and he managed to nick it.
This is not uncommon for racing drivers, is it? Particularly in a scenario where, assuming Red Bull retains its advantage through the season, it's very, very hard to see anyone who's not driving a Red Bull fighting for the championship. So you've got two drivers who know they're almost in a closed system, aren't they, Mark? They know one of the two of them is going to win. I'm not comparing the individuals to kind of Prost, Senna or Hamilton, Rosberg or, I don't know, Villeneuve, Pironi in 82. We were talking about them on a recent podcast. But this is a common formula, isn't it? When you have two drivers within the same ecosystem, they will push, and Perez also knows Verstappen will push, which is why Perez was a little bit suspicious and watching his mirrors as well, and very wise to not backing off too much until he knew Verstappen was going to. So that's just the game, isn't it?
It is, and it's, you know, it's just, it's part of racing, and in that situation, you have to get control of the driver behind if you want to control the pace of both of them. You can't ask the driver in front to back off because, as Perez said, you would, when they asked him to do 33 zeros, he said, "What's Max doing?" They said, "Well, 32.6." He said, "Well, why are you asking me to do 33 zeros?" Which is a, you know, fair point. You got to control the driver behind, and Max wasn't up for being controlled, so that's that.
And the big problem is that both Verstappen and Perez know that whatever happens in these arguments, ultimately Verstappen will win them in the big picture. So I'm quite interested to see how aggressive Perez is willing to be down the line when maybe he's in a position to try and push things a little bit, because this is going to be probably his best chance at winning a world championship. I'd be very surprised if he can take the fight to Verstappen over a full season. I don't think he's quite good enough to, and that's within the context that Max Verstappen's an all-time great. Sergio Perez is a very, very good Grand Prix driver, but as we always say, just not so easy to take on one of those greats. But that'd be an interesting little subplot for us to keep an eye on. I think we saw a little hint of it here. It was all very storm in a teacup, didn't really matter, but on another day, it could matter. Now, Scott, Mercedes, George Russell took third after Alonso's penalty. Lewis Hamilton was fifth, and of course, George Russell dropped back to fourth a few hours after the race. So was this a better weekend for Mercedes? Was it a worse weekend? Is there much to draw from it?
I don't think we learned a huge amount that we didn't already know about that car. It is a limited car. It doesn't have enough downforce. It's not the easiest to get into the right setup window. It seemed to look after its tyres a little bit better here than in Bahrain, but obviously the demands of the circuit are different to Bahrain, so it's not quite the same challenge. Russell clearly got the car into a better working window than Hamilton did. I got the impression, speaking to Lewis after qualifying and the race, that he just sort of went in a setup direction, not vastly different to Russell's, but different enough that it just seemed to not be right. Ultimately, I think Hamilton, on reflection at the end of the weekend, did say he got it wrong on setup. It made it very, very nervy and uncomfortable to drive in qualifying. And obviously, you took the edge off of that in the race when you're no longer right on that knife edge, but it still wasn't something he felt he could lean on. He hasn't had confidence in the car all weekends. I think Russell's done a better job. He probably didn't manufacture in his own problems, which it sounds like Hamilton did a little bit with the way that he wanted to try and adjust the car setup. But overall, it's just broadly where Mercedes is at the moment. Best case scenario, if something happens to the faster cars, it might be able to steal a podium. The only, I think, surprise from a Mercedes point of view this weekend is that they were ahead of Ferrari.
Well, this is a good moment to talk about Ferrari then, Mark. They talked up their chances of an improved showing this weekend. Charles Leclerc was second quickest in qualifying, ended up seventh in the race behind teammate Carlos Sainz. Is there any reason to draw any optimism from this, or did it pretty much confirm Ferrari is where they appear to be in Bahrain in terms of what their strengths and weaknesses are, weaknesses in particular?
Yeah, I think quite similar to Bahrain. That was a beautiful lap from Leclerc. It flattered the car. I don't think it should have really been there. It was, I think it was one of those special laps that Leclerc can do. But the car wasn't a disaster. If you ignore the Red Bull, it's like the story of every team, I think. If you ignore the Red Bull, it's in the ballpark. It's sort of tends to be a little bit quicker than Mercedes over a lap, about the same over a race distance, not too far behind the Aston Martin on race pace, but probably a little bit. I think that's just where they are at the moment. And you know, they brought a few little development tweaks to it, which may have helped the efficiency of it a little bit, but basically, you know, it's not there. We haven't seen any little glimpse that makes us think, yeah, that is, we've seen something there, and if they can hone in on that, we're going to start seeing progress. I think it's, you know, I think if Red Bull had not done such a dynamite car and had come up with a, you know, just a car as good as, say, the 21 car, I think Ferrari would be very, very happy with this car. I think they would, you know, it would be there up the front, and they would be quite satisfied that it was balanced, and, you know, but it's got a few weaknesses, and it's up against a car which I think is going to go down in history as one of the great ones.
Yeah, well, it's all relative, isn't it? And Red Bull has thoroughly smashed the grading curve with this. And we should say, for all the complaints about things being predictable, Red Bull have done an absolutely fantastic job. You've got to tip your hat to them. Really good job by everyone at Milton Keynes to produce such a strong car and then make the most out of it at the track. I don't think it's ever the dominant force's fault when they're making it boring by doing what they're there to do. It's down to the others to raise their game. But Scott, I was interested again, Fred Vasseur after the race, we were both in his little media gathering, and just as in Bahrain, he was trying to accentuate the positive. He was talking about the need to more consistently extract the performance from the car. He seemed to be, I know he's got to do that, but he just seemed to be accentuating the positive a little bit too much, didn't he?
Yeah, I'm a little bit worried that there's a bit too much of him saying, well, you know, we need to get the most out of this car before we talk about upgrades and things like this. Like, that car needs to be better. I think they're leaning a little bit too much on the raw one lap pace that Leclerc's able to drag out of it, and kind of using that as a bit of a false North Star to what that car's actually capable of. I think, just to sort of build on what Mark said, I think Leclerc flatters that car over one lap. And we know how many cars have we seen over the years that just look a little bit better in qualifying than they do in the race, because the grip of a new soft tyre on low fuel does mask some of the more underlying weaknesses. And if you look at how they struggled, I mean, one thing Vasseur did admit to was the huge deficit, huge being the word he used, to Red Bull on the hard tyres. Not just Red Bull either. They couldn't match Mercedes. They weren't a match for Aston Martin on the hard tyre in the second stint of this race. So there's serious long run pace that is a concern there. And I think if you compare that to Mercedes, just to go back to that team briefly, Mercedes has, and I know he had a bit of criticism for maybe overly fronting up to its issues and being too apologetic and all of this to fans, but at least there's been an outright admission from the beginning that car's not quick enough, over whether it's one lap or race pace or balance or whatever. And this isn't to say that Vasseur is repeating an old Ferrari trick by refusing to acknowledge that there's a problem. I just think I'm just a bit worried that they might lean a bit too heavily on the one lap pace and get a bit misled. So it's not about denying that there's a problem. It's just, if there is a core limitation to that car, are they just being a bit too slow to realise it?
Well, Carlos Sainz, speaking to him after the race, he said that the team knows exactly where they need to improve, what they've got wrong, where the weaknesses are. Obviously, the tyre management is a big problem. But the question is, can they do enough to it to turn things around? I mean, ultimately, they're in a battle to be second best, really. I think that's going to be the story for the rest of the season. That's a big challenge for them, because I don't really see Ferrari being able to take on Red Bull on a normal circuit in the immediate future anyway.
Yeah, just to, you mentioned the signs thing, just to read out this quote that he gave afterwards, because I think this sort of sums up the Ferrari plight perfectly. He said that they're not where they need to be right now in terms of race pace, tyre degradation, balance, dirty air when following. We just struggle a bit. If we already overheat the tyres in clean air, imagine following. We just eat them alive, and we need clean air to produce some kind of decent lap time. That is all round just quite a miserable assessment of a car, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Not quite as bad as Franz Tost's assessment of the AlphaTauri earlier in the weekend.
Yes, we're going to get onto that one in a moment. But first, we've got to take a quick trip to the French Quarter and Alpine, because Scott, I know you'll be disappointed. Esteban Ocon and Pierre Gasly eschewed the chance to fulfil your prophecy by becoming the first pair of teammates to collide this year when they restarted together, but they finished 8th and 9th. Seemed very predictable, didn't it, really?
Yeah, I think that team and car and driver lineup sort of slotted into their natural position this weekend. That car is exactly as fast as we thought it would be. It is clearly fast enough to get both cars into the top 10. It is the lead car in that new midfield, and it's just lacking a little bit to be really on terms with the Mercedes and the Ferrari and by extension the Aston Martin as well. They did kind of feel that they might be able to go with Ferrari in this race, but they just didn't quite have enough on race pace, which was frustrating. It's ultimately like a solid enough start to the season for Alpine, but actually the way Ocon put it, once he finally understood my question after I completely threw him by using the phrase grading curve, which he just had no idea what I was on about. But I'm just asking him to, you know, in the context of Aston Martin's huge step throwing what we might consider to be good for a midfield team, how happy is he with Alpine's progress year on year, where they've started the season? And he said they can't be happy with this. They're not happy with these positions. I think he's maybe being a little bit harsh, because I just think realistically, I know what I have reservations about what that team's capable of. But if you look at their big ambitions for this year, which was to finish fourth, a better fourth, a fourth that's closer to third, they're not going to do that with the car as it is now, so it needs improving.
Yeah, Alain Permain said the same thing after the race. They need to make some big gains. They've got lots of upgrades planned. They're quite confident that they will make progress, but yeah, they just need another 0.3 almost of race pace would be pretty significant in terms of transforming things for them. But it's all just sort of fine. It's not bad for Alpine, but it's not brilliant. I think that's the main thing. And yeah, Ocon and Gasly very much where they were going to be. Obviously, the safety car timing didn't help either of them, but it didn't fundamentally change their result. Mark, AlphaTauri, Yuki Tsunoda, he gave scoring a point such a good go. And this is in a car that was, of course, designed and built by People Team Principal Franz Tost, says he doesn't trust. So Tsunoda had that 10th place until Magnussen got him late on, I think, with just under 5 laps to go. So what did he make of his race and the wider AlphaTauri situation?
I think Yuki drove a good, solid race, and he was, you know, he gave it everything in defending from the Haas. But yeah, I mean, it's the car's where it is. It looked better around Jeddah than in Bahrain, so it's I think we'll get a clue whether it's actually making progress when we get to Melbourne and some of the slower corners on that track to see if it loses time there. But yeah, that whole, you couldn't definitively say which is the slowest car, but that's in the reckoning. And sometimes it's that car, and sometimes it's the Williams, and sometimes it's the Alfa Romeo, and sometimes it's the Haas. That group is, you just a tenth of a second of driver performance will move you up a lot. And so I think there's going to be quite a lot of pressure on the drivers in those teams to sort of really dig deep, because the rewards in terms of grid position and places are going to be quite big. And the AlphaTauri drivers are right in the middle of that group, yeah.
And of course, the engineering team, Scott, are going to dig deep after Franz Tost's kind words.
Yeah, he said that he doesn't trust them anymore after the gains that he was promised over the winter, and how that's manifested itself in a car that's, well, to summarise what Tost said, it's not very good at braking, it's not very good at cornering, it's not very good at accelerating. Other than that, sounds like a pretty good car. And he just says that why should he trust them now when they talk about gains that are going to come with their upgrades? He did apparently try to row back on that a little bit later in a different interview or something else, where he said he was joking. But he was given every chance in the press conference he made these comments to say I was kidding. But he doubled down on them and just said, what else am I supposed to say when this is the reality? So, yeah, I don't think it was the most inspiring motivational call that he could have made. But I suspect that that's just the kind of thing that people working in a Franz Tost-led team are just used to, because ultimately this is the same man who produced his comment a couple of years ago about basically that team people should just be really like happy and grateful that they work in Formula One, and if they had to work every weekend of the year, they should be happy with that, basically, because he'd be up for it.
Yeah, it's very Franz Tost. There's a certain Austrian bluntness to it, and you can't completely disagree with the fact that he characterised things haven't gone so well for AlphaTauri so far this season. The car isn't quite where it needs to be. Perhaps not the best voiced criticism, but at least they're on the edge of the points. And as we said, Tsunoda wasn't too far off at all before Kevin Magnussen got his first point of the season in the Haas. We'll get back to the pod in a moment, but first, a word about our partner, Grammarly. No matter what kind of work you do, how you communicate is key. All those emails, reports, and presentations are equally important to the collaboration needed to get things done. And Grammarly can help. Grammarly is your AI writing partner to help you communicate more effectively and efficiently so you can make a bigger impact at work. I know from experience that Grammarly can help you save time on any writing task and ensure you feel confident about what you've produced. In fact, 96% of Grammarly's users report that Grammarly helps them craft more impactful writing, and their tone suggestions can help you navigate even the most difficult work conversations. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Sign up and download for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done. Well, as always, we have a vast number of questions from the Race Members Club. Head to therace.com and don't forget the hyphen and click on Join the Race to find out more about member benefits. But we'll try and get through as many of these questions as we can. The first is from Stephen Camp, which will aim at you, Mark. What is it about Red Bull's ability to dump drag at high speed? Is it a setup trick or a fundamental design input, suspension setup, etc.?
Well, I think if we knew, so would Mercedes and Ferrari and McLaren and everyone else. They've got clearly a much deeper, nuanced understanding of underbody aerodynamics than any other team. And I think that's a little bit what concerns me when you hear Mercedes and Ferrari talking about the changes that they know where they are lacking. It's one thing knowing where you're lacking, but it's another thing to know how to not be lacking and where that deficit is actually coming from. It's clearly aero efficiency in terms of how much downforce for how little drag you can carry. The Red Bull is just in a different league this year to any other car, and it doesn't look ostensibly all that different from last year's car, but it's a lot faster. It's made big gains. I think only Aston Martin has made bigger gains, and that, you know, you're starting from a much lower base, you know, whereas Red Bull's starting from a championship dominant car in the first place. So I think it's all down to the fundamental underbody concept. It's not noticeably different from lots of cars on the upper body surfaces that we can see. But we can see that it does carry a lot of downforce for very little drag. And yeah, suspension is all part of getting that to work. And it does carry an awful lot of anti-dive geometry on the front suspension. So they've clearly got a way of making it work, without the car moving its center of pressure forward very much under braking. Maybe that's part of the clue as to how you get this combination that's proved so elusive for so many of entry stability but mid-corner rotation. So yeah, it's all in there somewhere, and when you crack that code, it's worth big lap time. But I think nobody else is even close to understanding it to the level that Red Bull have. I think they've just got such a brilliant understanding and can control what the air is doing and understand what the air is doing in a way the others don't.
Yeah, I did ask Toto Wolff what he thought the lag would be in terms of building that understanding to be able to match Red Bull. And he was saying it's 6 to 12 months, which might even be optimistic given how good a handle Red Bull have got on it. But yeah, a huge challenge for everyone else to take on. Scott, a question from Chris Parrott, who says, can Perez take the fight to Verstappen? Or was this an opportunity for Red Bull to keep up the pretense of parity between the two drivers, given the likelihood that Verstappen will outperform Perez in the long run?
I think this was a very convenient opportunity for Red Bull to allow Perez to have a free run at victory, race two of the season. It wouldn't do Red Bull any favours to be seen invoking team orders, especially when it was unnecessary. In the end, Perez's pace genuinely prevented Red Bull from having a problem to solve. He was so fast that even when Verstappen was just throwing everything he could at it and trying to win that race, he actually couldn't do it. So I think it just shows that Perez can, on his day in certain situations, do a very, very good job against Verstappen. But I do think that underlying feeling that he won't be able to do that often enough allows Red Bull to be like, well, it's okay, we can, this will resolve itself essentially over the season. But it certainly didn't hurt Red Bull to be able to have a nice little 1-1 early in the year, just to show that Perez can have his ambitions. It's just long term, he probably won't really realise them.
Yeah, and Perez certainly has a quality of equipment. There's no doubt about that. But Verstappen ultimately is the lead driver, and he is the better all-round driver. A question from Jeremy Husted, who says, given the state of Mercedes, his attitude towards losing, Toto Wolff's comments about his future, and the recent sacking of his physio for no apparent reason, is there a possibility we could see Hamilton retire this year, maybe even before the season finishes? I think we should say in answer to that question that I don't think we've seen any evidence that it was sacking of Angela Cullen. I think she moved on for various reasons. All seems like it's all very good terms. It's just sometimes people move on into other jobs and other phases of their life. So I don't think that needs to be thrown in with it. And yeah, Hamilton doesn't like losing. Not many of these people do. Certainly not the champions. So I think Hamilton's certainly not particularly happy, because he came into this season thinking, right, I've had the bad year, now I can go in and fight for the title. Oh, massive deflation. It'll take him a little bit of time to get to come to terms with that. But I don't think he'll walk away during the season. I think he's inclined to carry on next year. Obviously, he's got to do the full contract with Mercedes. But yeah, I think he's going to keep battling on. This was just one of those weekends where he was quite low because of the struggles. And that sometimes happens in these sorts of situations. A connected question for you, Mark, from Francis Gier, who says, what do you make of Toto's comment that he would understand if Hamilton wanted to leave the team? To me, it almost sounds like Toto is trying to open the door to show Hamilton out. Might he be thinking that it's time for Hamilton to pass the baton over to Russell and is using the current underperformance as a perfect catalyst to set that direction?
I think you're probably reading a little bit too much into it to coming up with that. You know, that analysis of the situation. I don't think if you've got Lewis Hamilton on your driving strengths, I don't think it would be a smart move to encourage him to leave. Just, you know, you've already got George Russell anyway, if Hamilton stays or goes. So it's not like you need to give Russell a chance. He's already there. So it's more a question of what would you do if you didn't have Lewis Hamilton? And, you know, there's not many options out there that you would say, yeah, that's the solution, because he's still, you know, one of the greatest drivers there is. And he's still ready to fight for championships if you give him a car. So you've given him a car which is, you know, a second a lap off the pace. Obviously, he's not going to be happy. And the solution isn't to encourage him to leave. The solution is to give him a car that's not a second a lap off the pace.
Question from Thomas Knight now for you, Scott. We've touched on this, but is this a positive or negative weekend for Alpine? Both cars in the points, head of the midfield, but only because Aston Martin seems to have bypassed it.
I think it's positive in the sense that they had a clean weekend, and Ocon said it's nice to finally get his season started for real after obviously that nightmare Bahrain Grand Prix where he picked up £1.01 penalties. But all it achieves really is it gets a few more points on the board. It shows where that car really is, and where that car really is not quite quick enough. So positive for more reasons than it was negative, but there is ultimately a realization coming away from this weekend, or a validation of an existing feeling, that Alpine is very much just a midfield team at the moment. And like I said earlier, it just needs to do a better job. They might have those developments coming, but it needs to get them on the car as quickly as possible and hope that they work as well as they did last year.
Another one for you now, Mark, from Oscar Robledo. Should there be a change in the rules to hinder Red Bull, or should they be applauded for having got it right?
I don't like this idea that, you know, you should tailor the regulations to make some carnival of excitement. You know, if it's a sport, and I know it's also a business, and the business relies on the viewers, but you've got to just take the rough with the smooth. And if somebody does a better job and you've set it up as a sport, then you just have to accept that some years your business is not going to be as good as other years. But to say that, right, this is not entertaining enough, we're just going to make it a bit more random, I think is just diluting the essence of the sport. The sport is about excellence. The sport's about excellence in not just drivers, but in design and technology and ingenuity. And when somebody does a better job, they win the race, and that's how it should be. Now, the others, as we touched on before, haven't yet got the level of understanding of this particular set of regulations that Red Bull has, but given enough time, they will do. Whether they do that through their own ingenuity or recruit others from Red Bull, that's just how it works. That's how the sport works. But if the competitive cycles are too long for the short attention spans, I think that's that shouldn't be the sports problem.
Yeah, 100%. Next question I'll take from Danny Elliott, who says, I was impressed with Piastri in qualifying. What did you think of McLaren's weekend on the whole? Yeah, Piastri was certainly impressive in qualifying. He was right there with Norris in the run-up to qualifying. Obviously, Norris made that slightly silly mistake, clipping the wall in Q1. Well, very silly mistake, I should say. A failure of concentration, a moment of inattentiveness. So, yeah, impressed with Piastri. He was unlucky at the start, got squeezed between the wall and Pierre Gasly. As he said, it was a racing incident, one of those things, but that ruined his race. And meant he had to pit for a new nose and was down at the back. But I'm impressed with Piastri in general. And I think McLaren's weekend, although it went very badly wrong, doubly so because the debris field from the Piastri damaged Norris's car as well. So he had to come in for a new nose at the end of lap two. So it was a disaster in terms of results for McLaren. But actually, the car wasn't too bad. It's not very quick on the straights here, but they were getting decent qualifying pace out of it, certainly in the hands of Piastri. So yeah, great job from Piastri. His numbers, his race results, I asked him about this after the race, looked terrible for his first two Grand Prix, but he's doing a good job and we started to see some of that magic from him in qualifying. Question from Chris Parrott for you, Mark, also on McLaren. Lando Norris was beaten on track by both F1 rookies today. How disappointed will he be with his personal performance over the first two races?
Oh, totally. I mean, it was an awful performance by Lando's standards. Yeah, just one of those weekends where he's just got it wrong and it's spiraled from there. So, yeah, it's not the real Lando. We'll see him back soon, I'm sure.
And we should say as well, in Bahrain, he qualified really well, pulled out a really, really good lap. So he wasn't bad in Bahrain, but it was just that really, really poor error in Q1, really, yeah.
And he was then, at the start of the race, the victim of debris from his own teammate's car. So the clash between Piastri, I say clash, it was really minor contact between Piastri and Pierre Gasly coming out of turn two, shed some debris that broke. So Piastri's front wing broke. And then Lando drove into it in that same moment, a few cars back, and broke his front wing, tried to carry on for an extra lap, but then realised the damage was too severe, and then that just sort of, yeah, race spiralled from there.
Yeah, which is why at the end of the race they were racing each other at the back of the grid, and Logan Sargeant, Norris almost got Logan Sargeant on the line, and Piastri had passed Sargeant at the start of the last lap. And the final question for you, Scott, this actually came in very, very similar wording from Adam Ryle-Waite and Sander van Hulten. He says, how much trouble are McLaren in now with the pace of others? It feels like there's a genuine chance of them failing to score points.
No, I don't think it's that bad. I worked it out. I'm pretty sure this is McLaren's the first season since 2017, the last Honda year, that they haven't scored points in the first two races. So if you do that lovely, completely arbitrary point of what you count as the start to a season, because when does a start no longer a start? This is McLaren's worst start since 2017, but it looks worse than it is. They could have scored points in Bahrain, and if Piastri hadn't had that problem on the opening lap, that clash, he may well have scored points today. I suspect that car would have been a bit of a handful to race with. It would have been very vulnerable in a straight line. The speed deficit that they had to the fastest cars on the straights in qualifying was massive. They just didn't have a low drag enough wing set to have for this race. But okay, it's very easy to say that you change a few details and their races are totally different, but that is literally the case for both McLarens in both races. They had a double DNF in Bahrain, and they had both cars in the pits by the end of the second lap in this race here. And Piastri's race was wrecked because I think obviously they switched to the hards, and when you have that safety car in the middle of the race, I think he only had used softs left or something. I think because he started on his only set of mediums that was left. So it's not like he has to stick to the end on the set of hards. There's nothing left to fight for. You're on a hiding to nothing there. So their race was wrecked, both cars, by the same incident effectively on lap one today. So it's just, they're not in a great situation by any means, and they need the car to get better. But it looks a lot worse than it really is.
It's really working towards that Baku upgrade at the end of next month. That's not too far off. That's just Australia to get through. Then they'll have the upgrade in Baku, which is a bit of a change of direction. We talked about that on previous podcasts. That's when McLaren's season really should start getting going. And they're definitely going to score points this year, and I think they'll have a decent championship position. It's just a pretty difficult start for multiple reasons. Well, thanks very much, Scott Mitchell-Malm and Mark Hughes, for your insights. Head to therace.com and don't forget the hyphen, as there's huge amounts to read there from F1 and the rest of the world of motorsport. Check out our other podcasts, including our Formula E podcasts, the IndyCar podcast, MotoGP, and Bring Back V10s. We've got a special charity episode of Bring Back V10s coming up where you can ask a question about any era of Formula One. So check out about that on our social media channels, and also have a look at our YouTube channel. Well, with two races in the books, we've got a pretty good idea which way the championship might be going. But stay with us for everything you need to know from the world of Formula One.
The Athletic.